Pulp Arcana, the Vintage Pulp Paperback Morgue.
Ocean of Death. 7-year-old Kelly had always loved to romp in the surf of California's endless summer. Then tragedy struck. A sailboat accident which took the lives of her parents and her sister Melissa. Now Kelly felt drawn to the sea for a different reason. She knew her sister wasn't really alone. Not as long as she could still hear Melissa calling to her at the ocean's edge and see her face where the sun glinted off the water. Sea of Terror. Brooke Hutchinson worried about the young niece who had been put into her care. Kelly's strangeness since the tragedy had made her the victim of her schoolmate's cruelty. She seemed to spend more and more time simply staring out to the sea. Then the accidents began, a series of gruesome water-related deaths, and Brooke realized with a chill of horror that someone was looking after Kelly all too well. Water Baby by Patricia Wallace, Zebra Books, 1987. She was caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. So the cover for Water Baby might be the most risible cover from the 80s skeleton craze era for book horror covers. Zebra invested heavily in their covers, as we know, and much of them were against a black backdrop. But this one's way more detailed, so to break it down, let's start with, I think this is the image of the mermaid, a skeleton mermaid with the scales and the tail and the fin of Dagon, fully bloomed. They're kind of like a silverish blue, like a pearl. They're more lifelike. The humanoid part of this mermaid is all skeleton, with big poofy 80s hair, mostly because it's underwater. That's kind of why it's poofed up. But hey, it fits for the late 80s too. Clutching a baby, just kind of like, this baby's kind of got the same expression as that other horror cover crib with the death-like cloaked figure holding the baby. It's just like going with the flow like babies do. They don't know what to be scared of when they're that young. And so the coloration really fits. It's successfully aquatic overall. They're nestled in a bed of seaweed and the waves lap around the book, actually. It even extends around. So it's really detailed and gaudy, and the water baby is written with hologram, so it glints in the light. Patricia Wallace's name is written pretty small under Water Baby at the top. The tagline is, she was caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. There's bubbles effervescing all around here. And I was going to touch on the colorations are all of the sea and the ocean, of what you would think. The seaweed's green, the water itself, they're underwater and it's different shades of blue. And the back cover takes on a bit different tone. It has these kind of waves and it's got a kind of teal cover and another shade of blue, and then the italic. The text is written in a green. So, yeah, definitely really cool. You gotta love it. Especially how the mermaid's just got like a skull full of blonde hair. She's so great. Okay, so I'm opening it up now. Well, first off, the retail on the back spine, it says Zebra Horror. The little icon picture is of the baby's face. That's questionable. I'm surprised they didn't do the mermaid skull. Retail for it, October 1987, is, yes, $3.95. Opening it up now, it has an excerpt called The Dead Sea, and it's the part where Toby gets killed in it, so I'm not going to read that excerpt. Opening it up to the next page, we have, like Zebra often did in their other books, is they would market their other books written in text with a short synopsis. And the ones they have featured in this are, it says, more horror blockbusters from Zebra's Masters of Terror. Nightcaller by Daniel Ransom, and that's a pen name. Fred Gorman, I believe. And that's the one where it's like a teenage girl. It's more of like a YA cover. It's a teenage girl sitting Indian style with the phone cord in front of her. She's wrapping the phone cord around her neck, and there's like a teddy bear sitting on the telephone itself, and of course half her face is a skull. And that's another great cover, becoming more rare by the year. The other one they advertise is Chain Letter by Ruby Jean Jensen. That's the one with the mailman, like the door-by-door mailman, on-foot mailman, handing the letter. I have a friend who, what's his name? Roger. He really loves this cover. This is one of his more favorite ones. This and Stage Fright. Then they advertise Water Baby, even though this is Water Baby. And the next one's Nightstone by Rick Catula. That's the one where it's like the little girl in like in the little girly dress, and her head's just like a hologram dome. It's like a fishbowl of like hologram. That's another great cover. I own that one. I started it, but it seemed just too cliche about like a family moving into a new house with a deep, dark secret, evil forces, powers taking over, and kind of lost interest with it 40 pages in, so I might pick it back up. The last one is Baby Grand. This was a collaborative effort by Joseph Keane and William W. Johnstone, the all-star from the Zebra cast. I'll read this. This cover, this is the cover where it's the skeleton playing the Baby Grand piano and grinning back at the audience. So the synopsis for this one, I'll just straight up read it. The children in town often heard a haunting melody rippling on the wind as if to lure them into the empty house. But if they were ever to follow the eerie strains of music, they would hear terror beyond their worst nightmares. For the Baby Grand was an instrument of horror, and it played a seductive song of evil, and its polished surface hid the stains of bright red blood. So people were being sacrificed on that Baby Grand? I don't know. That's another one I've had the chance of getting but haven't been able to acquire yet. So moving on to the other page, it's a title page. It says Water Baby by Patricia Wallace. Zebra Books, Kensington Publishing Corporation. Turning the next page here, we got our informational section of copyrights and publisher address. And Zebra Books, all rights reserved. No parts of this book may be reproduced in any form or by any means without the prior written consent of the publisher, excepting brief quotes used in reviews. Like I'm gonna do to excoriate it later. First printing October 1987, printed in the United States of America. Good, given the Americans jobs, that's good for you, Kensington Publishing. For Andy and Sugar Jay. I wonder if they actually publish these books in New York City, because you know how all the big publishers are in New York City. They must be. Okay, so we have, the sea has never been friendly to man. At most, it has been the accomplice of human restlessness. That's a quote by Joseph Conrad. Excuse me for being naive if I don't know who Joseph Conrad is. Maybe I should look it up. It's kind of embarrassing. Or maybe not. Maybe he's so inconsequential. So that was a quote. You turn the page and it opens up with a prologue. So that was the book, the cover, and the first inside pages to Water Baby. Stay tuned for more segments, including the review coming up. On to the main topic of this episode, Water Baby, the book. Now, on the Pulp Arcanum podcast, when it comes to reviews of the book, we are definitely going to break it down, spoilery, narrative by narrative, the summary, not just the summary, but characters, illustrating it so that it comes vividly to life for you in the imagination to live through it. Because a lot of these books are trashy, you're not going to get time to read them all, and you could vicariously experience it. So, to break it down in its most simplest form to start here, let's define what genre Water Baby is. Because if based off its cover, not too many reviews are out there for it, and you would think that it would be a mermaid horror. It's got one of the most recognizable and trashy and lovable horror covers of the 80s horror paperbacks. It's graphic, it's detailed. I break it down earlier in a segment, obviously. But to define the genre, it's sadly, it's not mermaid or mythical involved at all. So it is very misleading, like many horror paperback covers. So that's a letdown. And as I do this review, there's only a handful of Goodread reviews of it, so you don't get too much information of it. So I'll be breaking it down. The prose is rather mediocre. Patricia Wallace came out with 7 or 8 books spanning from the 1982 to the early 90s. A lot of her covers are recognizable, very collectible. She was gifted with some of the better covers of the era. She was wrote several of her books were published by Zebra. But so in terms of mermaid horror, though, other books, I was searching my best for others. I know Siren, coincidentally reviewed earlier in the last episode, which was Satyr by Linda Crockett Gray. Her other book, Siren, features a mermaid type of character on the cover. I don't know too much in depth about that story. But there's also a Charles L. Grant novel. I don't know if it's a novel of his or another collection of his short stories, Night Songs, that features a black mermaid on that cover. I have that one too. Haven't read it. But there's also Lake Michigan, Mermaids of Lake Michigan, and a lot of modern day. Though that's in terms of the vintage horror I already talked about that I could find. If you know any others, please let me know. I'll share it on the Facebook page or whatnot. Obviously, there's a lot of self-published books and rather series this decade too. Release, but they tend to fall into more YA or mythical romance, and there's a few horror in there. But so moving on now to Patricia Wallace, our writer at hand. Instead of doing an author profile, I'm just going to talk about it in the discussion here. So she did these novels spanning from 1982 to 1992. Traces came out in 1982. The Taint came out in 1983. Children's Ward, this is where she comes into her own and she really gets the iconic covers. This is the one featuring the skeleton caressing a baby. It's a hospital skeleton. Only Child, I believe, that's another great one. Twice Blessed. Okay, this is one I have. It's a skeleton nurse holding twins, one in each hand. I own this one, haven't read it. That's another zebra one. Great skeleton cover. Gotta love the zebra skeleton covers. See No Evil. This features a little girl, bug-eyed, on her deathbed, in her coffin, I believe, holding some death poxy flowers. Of course, she's a little skeleton girl, not just a little girl. It was a common type of setup. The kid in a coffin. You see, I think Seed of Evil had that, and there was a few makeups of a kid laying in the coffin, that overhead shot. So that's another collectible great one. Monday's Child, Lullaby, Thrills. So you see the theme here. Hospitals and kids. Kitty horror every time. I mean, they were written for adults and everything. So you can tell she had a hospital background. And as I talk more about Water Baby here, you'll see that. And I'd say more of the Water Baby themes are... So we don't get the Skeleton Mermaid, sadly. It's the biggest letdown. You want that skeleton mermaid gifting or birthing that baby like a stork to the life on Earth, on shore. You want that aquatic boon coming out, and you don't get it at all. It's a letdown. But it's more supernatural. I don't want to reveal the whole thing now. We're gonna tell it in a more story form. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a guest. No one wanted to read Water Baby. No one had Water Baby. Like I said, it's not the most popular. And even though Patricia Wallace did some of the more memorable and collectible horror books of the mid to late 80s, she's not that likable because she's not that great of a writer. And it's clear. So, we'll get into this. It's important to note up front here. There's a slew of characters. It gets really convoluted. It gets to the point where it's like, metaphorically, to make something, comparison, it's like going to a party and, you know, you're introduced to person after person and you start to retain some of the names, but then you feel like it's inconsequential because you're like, I'm never going to meet this person again, or they're not intelligent or interesting. So what's the point of remembering their name? And that's how this story gets. You don't know who to follow. It's pretty aimless, generally speaking here. So when I am explicating this story to you and it gets a little confusing, I'm doing my best to make it comprehensible because it gets a little convoluted with all the character names and everything. So I'm going to generalize a lot here, especially since I have no one to bounce off with and give other input. And frankly, this story was short. I think it's only one of those like 200-page books or something. Maybe it's 300. You know how they made the print bigger to some of the books to make it a little longer. So it was a quick and brief read, and the deaths overall, there's definitely a handful of them with all these characters and everything, but they weren't too graphic, and she's not that compelling of a writer, and of course it's full with different platitudes and such. So overall, I wouldn't really recommend it. So let's get into Water Baby and the storyline. With the prologue, we'll open up. We open up at sea. It's waves crashing, the usual type of oceanic treachery. The waters are rising. They're engulfing this ship. And it's not a ship manned by a crew or anything. It's actually a family. A woman named Al, their names really aren't consequential because they die in this opening scene, essentially. It's a couple, around generally 35 or so, and their two kids. So it leaves it equivocal as to the outcome of what happens with the boat, but that's just one way of getting away with cutting the scene and not getting into the graphic detail. Maybe the author's choice and hitting that audience of female women who don't want to get the thrills and the scares but don't want the gore. And that's fine. Anyway, so chapter one, it cuts. We're at the hospital. There's a detective, of course. He's investigating the capsized boat. The parents are found petrified underwater in terror. So, and there was no sign of the two kids at first. And we cut to the woman's sister. This is our main character. Her name's Brooke. And she's in her mid to late 20s, I'd say. It goes into this thing where she's way back. She lives in Southern California. This happened more so in Northern California on the coastline. Or a little farther north than Southern California. Brooke's an aspiring actress. And she is the sister of Allison, the woman who obviously was involved in the accident. Her family was involved in the accident. So she's getting called. She's the next of kin getting called. And she's walking back into her apartment, and I thought it was interesting to note that there was this scene where they mentioned that she forgot to turn on her state-of-the-art $180 answering machine. And back in the day, answering machines were an accessory to phones, and to think that they were $180 accessory, when nowadays no one even leaves voicemails, essentially, unless it's important. But generally socially, they don't leave. It's more of a texting society. But $180 just for the state of our answering machine, I find that a bit of hilarious. Anyway, so she gets that phone call about the accident. She shows up at the hospital. The sister and husband are dead at the hospital at this point. So Brooke takes over as the lead character. So we found our lead, Brooke. And she's, of course, a vapid blonde aspiring actress. Not too much. You think that she would take on this role of, like, empathy and, like, drive to, like, find out the mystery. There is no mystery. I mean, there was no sabotage. It was just an unfortunate catastrophe out at sea. Speaking about out at sea and climate catastrophes and everything, this would be something that definitely would make the worldwide news and everything. They're always pushing natural disasters and such. So this would definitely make headline news. Let's just be honest. Anyway, at the hospital, she's there. Meanwhile, Kelly, they found one girl, the only daughter that survived. She's about 9-10 year old. So it sets up the topos of the usual little girl survives the disaster, and there's something strange and weird about her. We don't know, but be extra vigilant and cautious around her because things are starting to get weird and strange, but we don't know it yet. She's in critical condition. And from this point on, we get a succession of menial nurse tests and doctor assessments. And we're in the field of where this author feels at home, the hospital. You can tell by, and this is me inferring here, that Patricia Wallace was a former nurse or in some sort of healthcare profession before writing these or during her writing these. Because she loves this and she talks about it very elaborately. And all of her books have that theme of the hospital. And anyway, so we're at the hospital and The Coast Guard informs Brooke that they couldn't find the other little girl, which is Melissa. That's key. The other little girl, Melissa, this is our water baby, hint, hint. This is our cover star. The freaking cherub jewel of Renaissance art when it comes to vintage horror paperbacks of the 1980s. Melissa, lost at sea. They can't find her because she's making her transmogrification to our water baby. And God, I love her for it. Anyway, we have a funeral scene. It's brief and nothing imperative happens here. It's for Allison and Jeremy, which is the main couple who die. The parents to the water baby who unfortunately perished off the pages because apparently it's too graphic to describe a drowning. So I even wrote so in my notes here. So ellipsis. Dr. Decker is our main doctor here. I'll leave it ambiguous as to his intentions for now. There's him involved, and there's also a psychiatrist, and they release Kelly, the little girl, into Brooke's guardianship and urge her to stay and raise Kelly in her family home would be the most copacetic for her condition and her being in misery and coping with all this. And this is no prison sentence either because Brooke, but it's away from the glitz of Hollywood and filming. But our setting for the book is the oceanscape along, I'd say, a Monterey Bay type of Northern California coastal land. I think it might be described, but I can't remember. But I mean, you could smell the turf, and we got promontories, and you know they're gonna come to play. It's a great playground. I got the aquatic sense. I was feeling like I needed that saline zephyr for the summertime. I started to read this book. I mean, I finished it like months ago. I mean, I'm filming this in July now, but it's a great quick kickoff to summer. So we're at the Cove here. You're feeling it. Weekend at Bernie's. But without the beach, we're talking more sheer and rocky cliffs here. So anyway, the doctors are like, oh man, she's been through so much. I mean, there could be disastrous consequences if you don't coddle her. But, I mean, this is spacious and luxurious beach house we're talking about. Anyway, we get two more clowns thrown into the mix. Two nurses, Felicia and Anne, and they're assigned to make house calls to the Cove. But really, Felicia isn't even making house calls. She's been to the area before, and she wanted to talk to Anne. And Felicia's the lecherous trollop in this, and she's just used as another character to get killed later on. And she's concerned over Anne being anew to the dangers of the sharks on the Cove, and it's just a bunch of two nurses used because it's just like two Patricia Wallace is like, hey, let me make like two boring characters that just remind me of my younger days to BS about nothing because it really means nothing because Felicia isn't even go to the house, like I said, and Anne's the one who's the house nurse assigned to the house. So let's move on. Kelly's starting to make a good recovery, the little girl, you know, and Brooke ends up like not like putting too much effort into helping with Kelly's convalescing here. She calls like her friend named Danny. He's a camera guy from LA, and there's nothing sexual about them. I mean, there should be, just to keep things, like, short and sweet. Instead, like, of them having a romance, They have to involve another dude, which is like the Coast Guard dude, who who is the one who saved Kelly from the boat, the capsized boat, and he really thinks he's a hero, and he takes on, like, the whole, like, cozying up to her and everything, and they still pull off this thing like they're searching for Melissa the whole book, even though, like, no one even cares. I mean, Brooke doesn't even care. She's just still living her life like, hey, Danny, bring up your camera. I still gotta film my scenes and send in my auditions. Shortly after the release, it's like, wow, okay. They head out to, like, scenic areas, too. Just completely bullshitting around, you know? And the head nurse ends up... Okay, this is, like, some hotel... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say hotel. Hospital. Let's shift gears here. There's some hospital intrigue here. The hospital's being sued. So the head nurse ends up phoning Anne, which is the house nurse that is looking after Kelly. She's like, oh my God, there's a huge mistake. Her latest tests show severe abnormalities in her brain waves. We shouldn't have let her go. This is a huge mistake. Is she doing okay? And the hospital instructs them to keep it, like, confidential because there's a similar pending lawsuit because... their brainwave machine gave her the wrong reads. So Kelly, who was saved from the drowning, the capsized boat, is having troubles, you know, like her brain function. She shouldn't have been released from the hospital. She's still having brain defects from whatever's going on and they're like, okay, this could be, like, huge, like, if anything happens to her, we'll be reliable. Anyway, we gotta, like, keep it on the down low because we're in the middle of court right now being sued, so just don't tell anyone and keep it cool. So monitor her, and they instruct her to actually sedate her with, like, if she's, like, having complications or paroxysms over the next 10 days, so that's about halfway through the book. I'll pick up the rest of this review on the flip side. We're talking about Water Baby 1987. Picking up on the second half of this review, a little recap here to where we left off. So an entire family became shipwrecked in a tempestuous storm, and there was only one survivor, a little girl named Kelly. So she's at the hospital, and she gets released into the care. Her family dies, and Brooke, our lead character, the sister of her mom, comes to watch her and take over in the family home on the picturesque California coastline, beautiful beach house. And here we go. The hospital read her brain scans wrong and she wasn't supposed to be released. So that's an element in play here when we lead off. So the other sister is named Melissa. It finally cuts back to her, our water baby. She's dead officially. She's an idle spirit waiting for rebirth. And we get to relive her watery doom. And her body and spirit is transferred to the darkness of the sea. It's something super ambiguous like that. And it hints at a special power in the ocean where starfish are able to regenerate limbs, and it praises some of the type of aquatic fish and creatures in the sea and doesn't elaborate too much on that, but that's just what it hints at and whatnot. So Melissa, she's about 10 herself. Her sister's about 9. She makes a vow to the reader, to the book, to whoever, to protect. She's a ghostly girl now. To protect her sister Kelly, who's still alive on the mainland. Okay, so Brooke. It goes back a little bit into her past. She's a complete worthless lead character, and she once had an abortion in college. She got knocked up by a documentary filmmaker. It plays no role in this story, really. Now, Kelly has the responsibility of her. Now she has the responsibility of Kelly to juggle her acting career. And from here on out, it starts. So you think it's going to follow that course. But no. We start bouncing around to too many characters. It gets really frustrating and broken into these bite-sized chapters like it's a YA novel. And the characters, each character has their own baggage and each motivation. And it's superfluous subplots that are just loose ends and frankly uninteresting. And the only really role they play is they just all kind of live in the vicinity. And so Kelly enters the water, the little girl. She's being drawn to the sea. And because she was meant to die, essentially, in the sea. So she regains and revives these powers. She's starting to have this special connection to the ocean. It hints at that. A type of, like, telepathic powers, like, reaped from the ocean is where it's going. Anyway, so, remember how there was an investigator, how I mentioned? This guy, first off, I don't understand what is there to investigate. There was nothing criminal about the sinking. And it isn't really fated in this novel of why this family sank and was it meant to be or was it orchestrated by some other evil forces. No, those evil forces are nameless. It just seems to have just drowned in this storm. So this guy, there's really nothing to investigate. I mean, there was a sinking and I don't really know who handles investigations in terms of offshore, if they have the Coast Guard does that or whatnot, or so there's water that port. So he's one of the first to die. He gets wasted and wrecks his vehicle, and water starts pouring in, and he glimpses an apparition of a pink dressed ghost girl. And so this is the theme of the book. All these people, all these characters that are kind of thrown in there as fringe involvement are slowly killed in ways by, like, water dangers of them, the water, like, drowning them, Final Destination style, you know, supernatural, natural forces. And we have seaweed, like, kind of come into life and tangle people. So that's the theme. That's the narrative that I'm going to break down the rest here. So we have another just random trollop who lives nearby who's just thrown in here. She doesn't work at the hospital. She doesn't even know the family. She just lives nearby and has a crush on young Toby, another, like, teenage boy with long hair who also lives nearby. And she ends up drowning on the beach and she's pulled underwater. Apparently. And Melissa morbidly watches her body drift out into the waves. So that's one of the more elaborate deaths. And here's something that you think might be crucial. We find out that the grandma is currently institutionalized, that being the grandma of Brooke and Kelly and the girls and everything, for a depressive condition of melancholia. And apparently it's hereditary. Another thing that's like, okay, melancholia is just a certain type of depression where it's kind of unexplainable, and you have irrational fears along with your severe sadness. And I say Kelly maybe experiences sort of that, but she's traumatized, you gotta think that. So that's why she's, Kelly, the little girl, is kind of one-dimensional in this. She doesn't have much of a personality. She's slow. She's impassive throughout and inexpressible. She's kind of just slowly, like, missing her sister and kind of goes about in a type of silence. Anyway, so Brooke starts dating the sailor that saved Kelly, another thing, like, is the guy that they met earlier at the hospital, and they throw him just so he could tell stories about how, of his effing heroism or something, and she starts falling for him in ways, and anyway, so back on to whatever happens. Let's keep the plot moving here. The wife of the neighbor who died earlier, there was another, like, the next door neighbor, just like a 60-year-old guy, just dies in his sauna. I don't know if I said that, but he gets tangled up by seaweed. She gets tangled up by seaweed. There really was no threat from them. Remember how I said Melissa, the ghostly girl, regenerated from the ocean? She is like floating back there, a floating phantom back to save her sister or protect her sister. But really, there's no one trying to kill her sister. Even the hospital is just looking out and trying to keep her safe, so they don't, to save their own asses. Because remember, we're dealing with like a medical thriller here too, that Patricia Wallace tries to throw in there, Robin Cook style. Anyway, so we have the billionaire, a billionaire who is Toby's dad. That's how Toby lives in the area, who also lives in the area. And he starts hooking up with the nurse, who is the one who I was talking about, who's just a total slut, and she just talks about salacious things of her hooking up with different doctors at the hospital. Well, this guy's cheating on his wife, and they're out on one of the precipices, and maybe it's precipices, who the hell knows, the plural enunciation. Guess what? The cliff collapses. Done. Executed by the ghost, of course. It's not like she's, like, hovering around and showing up, like, Goosebumps style, like, all cheesy and doing all this. It's more, like, explained, like I said, Final Destination, the elements of the ocean, the rocky, in this case, the rocky cliff crumbles and they fall off the edge into their death. Anyway, moving on, Brooke visits her mother in the hospital, the one who was institutionalized, and which is a total lost practice in this nation, since there's so many condemned asylums that are assumed haunted and frequently trespassed against, instead of institutionalize our mentally insane now. We just medicate them here in the U.S. So this is kind of a little throwback here. Like, reminds you of seeing old grandma in the institution. So, but guess what? There's nothing of importance to the plot. I don't even remember, because I don't know if it's an incompletion in my notes, if I didn't write it down what it was, or there wasn't anything important to write down. That I can't really explain on my behalf. So, moving on here. Remember the doctors involved? Well, guess what? The main one, he was kind of altruistic. He cares, okay? So you think he's going to get more involved and do some things and run around, but he's just kind of bickering and bitching about it to, like, his superior, who's a guy named Sawyer, and they argue about the misread EEGs, and the head superior, Dr. Sawyer, doesn't want to admit the failure. He just wants to keep it on the down low and not admit it. By the way, the lawsuit was resolved, and they were able to, like, defend it and not get sued for it. And while Decker hits Sawyer with some hard stricture for the mishap, and Sawyer admonishes him back with calling him out for his, like, self-righteous ethics. And bottom line here, he's like, listen, no human has been, nothing's been done, no one's been harmed, which is somewhat true, because everything that's happening's Water Baby's fault. It's Water Baby's fault. Point the finger at the cherub, the evil little cherub. It's all her deaths. I mean, Kelly's hasn't been, like, killing people. She's just been, like, tagging along with Brooke on whatever date she goes on it in the background. Like, that's what's the update on that. Anyway, so moving on. Brooke has Eric, the Navy Coast Guard, over for dinner date. He brings roses and brags about his bravery and jumping in to save Kelly. And Brooke ends up cooking a medley salad and broils some shark fillets. And Kelly is there murmuring like a one-dimensional little girl because that's all we ever get from her. And remember Toby, the teenager who walks around like a surfer dude with his angst and shirt off. He's on a guilt trip over wishing his father to die because he hates his dad because he cheats on his mom. So, but he's kind of like his dad because he's sleeping with other married women himself, like that one who died earlier. Anyway, this is leading up to the climax here. So this is all going to be wrapped up within the last 5 minutes. So obviously for the climax, we're dealing with the ocean here. We're not dealing with fires. It's not going to be a fire ending. It's going to be a monsoon type of ending, okay? So the tide rolls in to shore, and Toby hallucinates of a little girl. He sees a little girl's face. I don't think he dies, from what I remember. So at this time, Brooke and the lieutenant are hooking up. So Brooke cements her legacy as totally worthless here. And Dr. Sawyer, the doctor who was like, had no care in the world over everything and doesn't know about any of these deaths, he feels guilty over it and he commits suicide with a medicated cocktail for whatever reason. They throw that in there too. Committed by our water baby once again. I don't remember. I didn't pick up on that. At least it wasn't documented in my notes here. Anyway, so the finale. Out on the beach. Brooke is being swallowed up by the tide. Brooke goes out there because they're looking for Kelly. Because Kelly goes out there, of course. Because she hears her calling. And her calling is to go to the ocean. And so Brooke runs after her because she has to do something as the main character in here. So they're like, all right, what do you got, Brooke? And she's being swallowed up by the waves. And she's entangled by animated seaweed. And it's very phantasmagorical in the seaweed and the implied apparitions in play. And Kelly and Melissa are there, and they're beckoning Brooke to join them to play in a game on the ocean floor. That's where they're at, on the ocean floor. That's their sandbox. They want Brooke to be her mommy. Why don't they want their own mommy to be their mommy? Didn't their mommy, like, also drown in the ocean? Their ghost isn't around anywhere. But they want Brooke to be there. Brooke's horrible. There's nothing enviable about Brooke. Anyway, so she suddenly resurfaces because we can't kill her. And as lightning transects the sky, and Eric, our Navy Coast Guard boy, he rescues her to shore, of course. And so we get an epilogue, and the epilogue is, since Kelly died, Kelly remains in the ocean. She's reclaimed by it and reunites with her sister. So Brooke is selling off the beachfront home, the million-dollar home. The furniture has been cleared out. The house is being sold. Algae began to pervade in Kelly's room and in the pool that they had. She ponders the facts for once. She does some investigation details, including how the seaweed and the ocean water was involved in every one of these deaths in the area. And the Super 8 film of their home videos, the girls appeared transparent in them. So she's catching on. She knows there's an afterlife. But this afterlife has no explanation or satisfaction on any side. So Brooke now muses that Kelly was meant to be reclaimed by the ocean and be with her sister eternally. But you're like, why wouldn't Brooke be with her sister too then? I don't get it. It's all a bunch of loose ends. There's no origin of evil. That's a detriment to this. And Melissa is killing people that aren't even going to harm Kelly. And Kelly... So that's the gist of how it goes down. It's a really second-rate mixture of incompletions. Why didn't someone exhort Patricia Wallace to trim these characters? Because also the nurse dies, and the other nurse. Just everyone dies. And it was so unnecessary. And there's some redemption to be had there. And it could have been more elaborate or scary. So there's no consequences to the hospital for them letting out Kelly early. They kind of leave that open. There's no explanation to how this oceanic possession happened. And so, therefore, it doesn't get my recommendation. I'm done. I've spoken enough about Walter Beatty from Patricia Wallace. Tune in next episode for a very special one. We got another skeleton coming along. It's going to be J.N. Williamson's Dead to the World. Look forward to that. This was JBM from VillainNews.com and the Pulp Arcanum podcast. Look for it on Instagram, Facebook. Message me. I want to have you guys on for different skull sessions. Let's talk about your collections and your history with horror fiction. Thank you for listening. And tune in for more segments, because it's not over. I have a discussion with a guy named Chris from Minnesota. So, tune in. All right, welcome to the discussion. This is JBM from VillainNews.com. I'm with a guy I met from a horror book group called Books of Horror. His name's Chris. He's from Minnesota. Say hi to the people.
Hey, everybody. It's nice to be a part of this.
Yeah. So we just met a little bit ago. We've known each other for a few months and seen each other's posts throughout the group and stuff. We kind of have similar interests in obscure 80s horror books. So we're just going to talk a little bit about our collections and our favorite books. And so we'll start with you, and let's just talk about your origins. Let's take it back to when you were early. Did your parents read to you growing up, or when did you start reading?
When I got into horror, it was probably about when I really got into it, it was probably middle school or so, because I remember one of the big movies that I liked growing up was Fright Night. And I think I just discovered horror books by the early Dean Koontz and the early Stephen King, like I'm sure a lot of people did, just from the library, and that's how I got into it.
Yeah, those are two authors that are definitely plastered over every shelf.
Yeah.
You could tell when a horror, when you go to different bookstores, if the horror section's been raided, because all that's left is Koontz, King, and maybe like some dusty Anne Rice's.
Yeah, no, that sucks.
So you started reading like Koontz and King in middle school. You skipped over Goosebumps, or you're what year were you born?
Yeah, I was born in 97, so I did watch Goosebumps back then, but I didn't really ever read it.
Yeah, I was born in 87, so they were really targeted towards my group. And yeah. I remember when Goosebumps used to be super pervasive at
every Scholastic book fair through every elementary. He was coming out with a few books, a book a month, and then and right in the height of it in the mid-90s and everything, I would read Attack of the Jack-O-Lanterns, and then they came out with the TV show. I had the Ghost book one, too. I only read, and then I read a few of the Slappies. I read about four or five Goosebumps back in elementary school in the mid-90s. So then how did your horror reading evolve then from Koontz and King after middle school?
Well, I discovered it really took off with all the more obscure ones because I discovered that Too Much Horror Fiction blog from the guy that you probably know it, but the guy that co-wrote
Paper Will Max. Eric.
Yeah. And after that, another guy in the group, Evans Light, who I talk to a lot, I saw his long Goodreads list of books that he got from thrift stores and whatever, because he categorized all of them, and that's discovering Evans' list was what made me discover way, way more of them. But yeah, Will's blog was what introduced me to the lesser known titles.
Yeah, and he launched that in 2010. And I remember at the time, like, his was really the only site, the only blog dedicated to horror paperbacks. No one was talking about it.
Yeah, exactly.
It just really wasn't discussed in the internet at that time. And he just kept being dedicated to it. And yeah, he's introduced me to so many different horror books and everything. And once he, like, and then you saw, like, the community would build up too. Like, he gets a lot of comments on it too, and you hear people's stories from back in the 80s and when these books were actually at drugstores and gas stations and grocery stores.
Yeah, it's really cool to look through all of that.
Yeah, so he writes tremendous articles. What's the other guy that you said you found the list from? Does he have a blog too?
No, he doesn't have a blog. He's an author and a editor who's in the group. He sells a lot of the books too, but yeah, he collects like pretty much every single lesser known horror book from the 70s through 90s, no matter what it is.
Nice. So yeah, so around that time, since it wasn't that popular and pervasive online, the collecting of it was still rather affordable. So yeah, I was able to start my collection back then. What really jump-started it is I've always been doing YouTube videos of horror movies, and I've always had a fascination with horror movies, DVDs, VHSs.
Yeah.
Collecting horror masks, Halloween props. And then I eventually traversed over and walked into the arena of horror paperbacks when I saw his blog and everything, and started seeing it. And that's when I started collecting, because I've always bought comic books and stuff on eBay and gone to garage sales. I live in Metro Detroit. So I would hit up all the thrift stores, all the garage sales. You know, I'd get like one book here, two books there, 10 cents, 50 cents, $1, $2. So I'm able to been able to cherry pick a nice collection over the years. And then, so I've built a decent collection. I also love occult books. I have different grimoires and kind of the 70s boom of black magic and the fascination of devilry after The Exorcist was released. And then, I know you know about this too, because I've heard you comment about it. Horror paperback genre in terms of popularity has really taken off by 2017 with the not only the Instagram world, but the Grady Hendrix and Will Erickson released Paperbacks from Hell.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I do appreciate it and think it's cool, but I mean, of course, I don't like it from the aspect of it's making things more expensive, especially books, some books that aren't even worth paying anything close to what they would sell for, just because people want them for the covers when they're actually really crappy books. But I mean, I do think it's cool that it's introducing people to it a lot easier, but I don't like it for the fact of the pricing and the all that.
Yeah, it's really doubled the price of a lot of books. Like, usually you could get a Guy N. Smith book for $5-6. Now they're going to be $10 to $15. Or you could get a William W. Johnstone for like $7 or $8. Now they're at least going to be $12 to $20.
Yeah, but, Johnstone's terrible, so it's not even worth paying for, in my opinion.
Yeah, and even before that book, he was still immensely popular, because you even go to a Barnes & Noble nowadays or a Walmart, and his Westerns, along with his nephew, are still plastered up on the shelves. So he's always had that notoriety, and then he did write, like, at least 15 horror books for Zebra and a few other printings. And, they've always been expensive. But he's had some of the... He was probably one of their most eminent writers, and he had some of the greatest covers.
Yeah, I do think that too, at least for more of his early 80s books.
I recently got Carnival. I remember I asked if you wanted to read that with me and do a review, and you just excoriated Johnstone. So, yeah. So were you one and done with Johnstone? Did you just read like Devil's Kiss or something and then gave up on it, or?
I read Wolfsbane, which wasn't that bad, but it was just more focused on sex than horror.
And, oh my God, I covet that one so much. That's actually what the logo is for the Pulp Arcanum podcast. It's the three-headed skull where he's holding the Wolfsbane and.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like a lizard coming out. So if you look at the logo of this podcast, you could barely see it. But yeah, I've always wanted that cover. And it seems to be more obscure now. Like, I can never find it. I'm trying to find it for $10. Like, if you stay persistent and stuff and you keep, like, I have a decent gauge for the market because I've been buying them online and in person for almost 10 years now. Yeah. And, if you stay patient, you could still come across every book for a decent price. Just haven't come across Wolfsbane in a while, but anything else you remember about it?
No, I mean, it was a little bit better than I thought it would be, but, I mean, for a book by him, knowing what I knew, but, yeah, because I had read that one and then The Uninvited, which was similar to The Nest, but it wasn't even remotely as good, and those are the only two I've read by him, and I wasn't interested enough to pursue it any further. So that was that.
I read Rocking Horse a few years ago and wrote a review for it on the villainnews.com website. That's one of his classic tropey Johnstone ones where family moves down south, inherits a haunted type of house. We got Bigfoot type of creatures haunting outside. We got professors who are in a devilish cult. We got the rocking horse that's possessed and comes to life quite often, gets shot up with a shotgun, vomits bilious fluid on the ground. It comes at you like there's a lot to offer. They're enjoyable. Like, it's not terrible. Like you said, I'm kind of like falling the same way as you, but I'm not going to abstain from them ever again. You sound like you want to abstain from them, but I enjoy collecting his books and reading them from time to time. And I still plan on reading Carnival.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe if I was a little bit older, I'd appreciate it more for the campiness alone, but for right now, I'm just focused on if I think a book is good enough, in my opinion, and then I'll keep it.
Do you have any friends in real life that are into horror books?
Yeah, I had one. There's a one girl that, like, my primary friend that I had given a lot of them to, and she was reading for a while, but she kind of stopped just because of work and life stuff. But nice. I know I gave her Childmare, if you know that book, and I wish I didn't, because it's worth kind of a lot.
Yeah, you got to be a proper curator of these books.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think another benefit from Paperbacks from Hell is it gave notice to these books, and it gave value to these books, and people should appreciate them, because for decades now, they've probably been thrown out, thrown in wood burners, burnt, thrown away. For years. That's how I got into it. My first zebra was a Sharon from Sharon Combs. My aunt had like a whole box of romance books, and my dad wanted me to burn it all. And I was going through the books, and I saw Jay Anson's Amityville Horror and Sharon from a zebra, and I was able to pluck out a few horror books from there. And that's what really was the catalyst that sparked me into horror books. Like, I was just gripped by Jay Anson's Amityville Horror. This was after growing up. In terms of, I read Goosebumps in elementary and whatnot in middle school, then didn't read too much in high school. And so this is what jolted me in my young adult life into the horror book. So yeah. So you see a lot more people collecting the horror paperbacks now, and that's nice. I think a lot of the Instagram collectors are just, like you said, collecting for the covers and everything. So that's driving the price up. That's inflating the prices. But at least those are being preserved, because you know it's going actually in the hands of collectors and stuff. So
yeah.
So that's one thing. What's the size of your collection? Because you mentioned that you give them away and stuff. What's it at right now? Do you display them? You keep them in boxes? What's the deal?
Yep, there's just one little drawer of them. It's about, let's see, it's like probably 20 something.
Are you a Kindle reader or anything?
Nope, just all the regular format.
Good, yeah. I've never really been into much of Kindle or digital reading either. Just can't get into it. I like the older, authentic ones. So, let's get into different genres of horror. What are some of the ones you prefer?
In
terms of ghost, haunted house, animal attack, witches.
Most of the ones I have are, most of the ones I have are killer kid books, but they're not, it's killer kid or killer teenager, then there's three, I think, that are Skinwalker books, and the rest are just mixed.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid those creepy kids out there when you're looking at the horror books. They're just everywhere in bunches.
Yeah.
I tend to not like to read those ones. I mean, there's so many of them. I mean, Ruby Jean Jensen wrote so many, and if I am going to read one, there's one from J.N. Williamson called The Banishing that he released through Playboy Press. You ever read any J.N. Williamson?
Yeah, I read Playmates, which was okay. It has a cool cover, but I mean, yeah, it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't anything special. And then I read Don't Take Away the Light, which a lot of people said was the only good horror book
book he wrote, and it was better than I expected it to be.
I'll have to check that one out. I'm in the middle of Dead to the World right now, the famous one with the skeleton jogger.
Oh, yeah.
In the windbreaker suit. Yeah, that's a classic one. Defying the creepy kid genre, then, since you've read a lot, what type of plot line do they usually follow?
Well, it's usually, for more of the ones I read, it's they either get possessed or under the influence of some entity that wants them to harm people, or there's actually a more unique one that was put out by Pocket in the early 80s, but it was interesting for Pocket because it was way more graphic than Pocket books usually are, because Pocket tends to be the publisher that is not as intense. But it's called Nightmare's Child by James Farber, and I haven't seen very many people mention that one, because it was about this boy, like him and his mom were pretty much homeless, and she was a hooker, and then she gets killed, and then it takes place in the desert, like in Arizona or something. So then he becomes feral, and then he gets taken in by a normal couple after he wanders into their yard, like a year later or something, and then he tries to act like a normal human boy, but it ends up going really, really bad.
How was he corrupted? By spirits or by like a savage tribe or something?
Well, no, he was raised by a wolf, so he couldn't talk or anything, and he ate roadkill and stuff like that. So,
oh God,
yeah, it's a good book, and for Pocket, it's surprising because it's pretty graphic, and Pocket never typically strayed towards graphic.
What other genres have you dipped into?
Like I said, another one that I like is the Skinwalker subgenre, even though there's not a whole lot of those, but the ones
the Native American horror.
Yeah.
One?
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to read Totem by Aaron Eli. You know that one?
Yeah, I know that one.
I'm partially through Obelisk, the one with the Egyptian obelisk that gets transported to NYC.
Yeah.
That's another great cover. She's not too bad of a writer. I haven't read Graham Masterson's... What's his first one? The Minotaur?
The Manitou.
Yeah, the Native American spirit.
Yeah.
Any Native American horror that sticks out to you?
Yeah, if you know who T. Chris Martindale is, he wrote...
Where the Chill Waits is really good by him. And there's a really obscure Canadian one called Cold Front by Barry Hammond, and that was...
Oh, you've read that?
Yeah, I have it.
Isn't that the one that Paperback Maniac reviewed?
Yeah, and they actually used the cover of it, even though it's not the right cover, but they used the cover of it on one of the Valancourt reprints to make it more exciting for people, I guess.
They reused it, or they didn't reuse it?
Yeah, they used it for a totally unrelated book, the Spirit by Thomas Page, or whatever the name of that is.
Oh, yeah, that's where that's from. That's why it kind of confused me. I didn't even notice that. That's a good pickup.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, speaking of Native American horror, I did read, I like reading the Amityville horror books, and Hans Holzer famously wrote Murder in Amityville. He was a famous occult writer from the 1970s. And he wrote over 100 occult books. There wasn't any sort of supernatural thing that the guy didn't exploit back then. He wrote about astrology, numerology, any type of ghostly encounter that anyone would sell him the rights to or give him the rights to write their story. And so he wrote Murder in Amityville, which was a prequel to the Lutz's story based on the actual murders of Ronald DeFeo, claiming that DeFeo was possessed by the spirit and ended up killing his family. Well, he followed that up with the Amityville Curse in 1980, I believe. I read it last fall and wrote an article on it and reviewed it. But so he ties, he's heavily into, he claims that he did research at the Amityville Library. And he's the one who brought actually the Native American, the psychic, Edith Myers or something. And when she was on the doorstep at 112 Ocean Avenue, she sensed the Native American chief spirit. So he went off on that and he tried to find a connection, however tenuous it may be, to connect it to the Native American curse, a la poltergeist style. And he found that there, with the proximity of Amityville being on the channel along the ocean, that it was used as kind of more like a convalescent area for Native Americans. So a lot of them died there due to being sick by the white man, as he claims. And so there was a chief that died on that property. And the fictional story that he writes that connected into is that these kids back in 1920 or something found his head buried on that property and they started playing football with it. He actually writes this in the book. And so that like started a, so he put the hex on anyone that became associated with that property. So like these three couples move in there after the Amityville Lutz story. This is set like 10 years after the Lutz story. And they're like, oh, well, there ain't no curse anymore. And we can move in there. The hysteria has died down and everything. So they move in there and obviously everyone pretty much dies one by one. But that's the connection with the Native American curse and everything in terms of Amityville.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I didn't really know the history behind that.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty deep. One thing I really love about Amityville, there's a lot of books to it, is the true life connection to it. It's like there's no true life Freddy Krueger, but there's a true life 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, New York.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you're from Minnesota. What's the book collecting like over there? You go to any bookstores?
Yeah, there's a lot of used bookstores in Minneapolis, and there's one specifically that's for horror and sci-fi and that stuff called Dream Haven. And I haven't been there in a while, but I bought stuff like I bought some of Ray Garden's early books there, and I bought a signed John Russo book there. So nice. stuff that you really wouldn't expect to find, I guess, in public.
Yeah. John Russo had some nice covers.
Yeah, the only one that I read was the one that I bought, which was The Majorettes, and that was fine. But I know that some of his other books have really terrible reviews, like for the writing and things like that.
Yeah, I read Midnight, which is the one where it's kind of like a holographic cover, and it's got the skull, and it's got the candle bleeding on top over the cranium and dripping over the curvature of it.
Yeah, I was curious about that one, too.
Yeah, that's solid, and they also did a movie adaptation of it, which is just horrible, cheap exploitation.
Yeah, Texas, I know.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre knockoff. But yeah. He's solid. He's just not that great. You could tell he got published a lot because of his association of with George A. Romero, the famous zombie director.
Yeah, definitely.
Because he let him do the Night of the Living Dead novelization.
Yeah.
And that kind of like spurred his writing career. Because he co-wrote the original movie, if I'm not mistaken, Night of the Living Dead, with George A. Romero.
Yeah.
And then he went on to do the novelization. It's kind of curious that he didn't team up with George A. Romero for some of his novelizations in the 70s. Because, you know, Martin, the 70s vampire movie?
Yeah.
There's a novelization of that that's pretty rare.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that.
And I think Susanna Sparrow writes that, co-writes that with him. And then there was, what's the sequel that he did? Is it Night of... What is it? It's Day of the Dead, or the one where in the mall.
I thought that was, wasn't that Return?
Yeah, Return of the Living Dead is the 1985 one.
Oh, and yeah.
The late 70s, it's Day of the Living Dead or something. I don't remember. But he also did the novelization, co-wrote that with Susanna Sparrow. Anyway, so any other horror topics you wanted to bring up?
Well, I guess, yeah, I know a little while ago when I met you, didn't I tell you about a little bit about the novelization of The Pit?
Yeah, Teddy?
Yeah.
Yeah, go, go ahead and give a synopsis for the people.
Yeah, well, the book, I mean, it's pretty, the straight normal gist is pretty similar to the movie and the book, but yeah, it's about a lonely boy in rural Wisconsin that most of his neighbors and teachers and all that don't like him, and he takes solace in this bear that tells him to do bad things to people and deliver people to these little monsters that live in a pit in a field nearby. And the bear is obviously not talking to him. And in the book especially, it's more touched upon that it's his schizophrenic or split personality. And yeah, the book is way more graphic and disturbing than the movie was. And I think even if they wanted to remake it fully today, they couldn't do it because of the content in the book.
Yeah, that's a horror movie that I've been meaning to watch. I watch a lot of 70s and 80s ones, but haven't gotten around to it. But the way you describe it, it almost sounds kind of like the Andrew Niederman movie/book, Pin.
Well, Pin is one of my favorite movies, but I mean, Pit, yeah, Pin is like serious, and the Pit movie is more, it's more unintentionally funny.
I see. Do you, have you read any other novelizations?
Yeah, I've read, let's see. Yeah, I've read Fright Night, which was pretty much exactly like the movie, except for it gave more backstory into Jerry Dandridge's character. Otherwise, there was nothing new about that. And then I read
that one. It was well written.
Yeah, it is well written, because I'm glad that Skip and Spector wrote it.
That's another one that just keeps climbing in price. And novelizations I used to collect too. That's another thing that I used to collect, and no one would even talk about them. I even, like, in real life, I'll mention them to people. People don't even know what a novelization is.
Yeah.
Well, nowadays they're so antiquated, but in terms of a collector's market, it's it's rising in popularity.
Yeah, and then the one other I read was the novelization of Night Warning, if you know that movie.
Maybe if I saw the image of it, it might evoke the memory of it, but
no. The book is called Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker.
What's that one about? I don't think I know then.
Oh, okay. But yeah, it's more of a psychological horror too, and it's just about this teen that he gets a scholarship to go away from high school for basketball, and then he lives with his aunt because his parents died in a car crash, and then his aunt is just psychotic, and it turns out that the aunt was actually, it's actually his mom, and she killed the two people that were that he thought were his parents. And yeah, it's a pretty good movie too.
Wow, nice. Kind of sounds like Psycho too, with his aunt and let's see here. You collect any horror magazines?
No, the only other thing that I was, I mean, I'm still into it, but I was more active into was VHS.
What's your VHS collection like?
Right now it's pretty minimal because I haven't got anything in a while, but I used to be really way more into it. And I had things like Maniac and Sleepaway Camp and like the rare expensive stuff, but it just got, the community is kind of annoying because it's all full of guys that are, I don't know, in their 30s and 40s that just take it way too seriously.
Yeah, I've loved 80s slasher and have done dozens of reviews on them for years, and yeah, VHS has just become getting more expensive too, more rare.
Yeah,
I had my VHS player die out on me like earlier this summer. I had to buy a new one. Just a used one's $40. If you want a new, they don't manufacture them anymore. So a new one in the box is still going to be roughly 20 years old from the late 90s.
Yeah.
And they're selling them for like $250. So, I mean, it's just getting more expensive. Plus, it's nice that they, a lot of these independent producers for Blu-rays, like The Shout Factory and Arrow and Severin Films, are all re-releasing a lot of these obscure horror movies.
Yeah.
It's so freaking expensive, though. Like, I don't know how anyone can get into it. It would be like the only sole thing that you'd have to get into, which usually some of these collectors, that's what they do. They're strictly Blu-ray collectors because you're paying $30 to $50 for some of these because they're limited releases, you know?
Yeah.
I got Kathy's Curse from Severin Films back in 2017. That was a package where they give you a mini poster and like a magnet and a few other things. But another thing is like VHSs, it's hard to store those. They get really heavy and they take up a lot of space. And luckily on YouTube, a lot of these obscure horror movies, you could pretty much spend the rest of the year watching nothing but horror movies on YouTube. That's how many there are from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I noticed that. Like a lot of the channels upload them for free too, so it's easy to watch.
Yeah, I would have gone broke watching all these horror movies if I would have sought them out on VHS or Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So, all right, man. Well, it was nice talking to you, and hopefully we can do this again sometime. Maybe we'll review a horror book. Just shoot me some images of books you're reading.
Yeah, it was nice doing this too, because I never had done anything like this before. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's still plenty more we could get into. I want to talk about different horror book publishers and different genres and different covers and stuff. So, yeah, I'll have you back on the Pulp Arcanum podcast in the future. And thanks. And we're out. Peace.
Yeah, thanks. See ya.
Following is an article excerpt written by Edward Bryant from Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone magazine, June 1989, in which he talks about the launching of Pulp House, a literary magazine that ran from 1988 to 1996. So, here it is, verbatim. I'll read it. It's a few paragraphs. There's a tough new kid in town, and when he, and sometimes it's she, talks, you'd better listen. What I'm making reference to is Pulp House. Pulp House Publishing, Box 1227, Eugene, Oregon. Edited by Christine Rush and published by Dean Wesley Smith, Pulp House is nominally a quarterly periodical. In fact, it refers to itself as the hardback magazine. But when something howls like a jaguar, pads like a jaguar, and has spots like a jaguar, chances are that when it leaps on you from a tree, you're dead meat. So let's say that Pulp House is a lot like a 4-times-a-year original anthology. This first volume is a state-of-the-art example of desktop publishing done well. The production values and design are executed marvelously. The format for issue 1 is 1,000 copies of a sewn binding hardback and 250 copies bound in leather, slipcased and signed by all contributors. Both editions are handsome. The plan for Pulp House is to rotate the editorial focus over the course of a year from horror, issue 1, to speculative fiction, fantasy, and science fiction. The contents of the first horror number are tremendously eclectic and largely successful. There is a healthy mix of new and familiar bylines. The excitement and energy levels are high. A few of the stories come across as the sort of occasionally stereotypes as Clarion Workshop exercises. Ambitious but arid. But the rest carve out new territory. Michael Bishop's A Father's Secret is a nasty, nasty examination of child abuse. Kidge Johnson's Ferrata takes an MTV-paced ride through vampirism and revenge fantasies. If the word weren't so dumb, vampunk might be appropriate. The Soft Whisper of Midnight Snow by Charles DeLint is a quietly paced tale of enormous ascending power as an artist learns the true nature of her work. Harlan Ellison contributes a brand new hard-nosed romance about a guy who falls hopelessly and helplessly in love with the wrong woman. Public Places by J.N. Williamson casts a remarkably unblinking eye on a very bad man beset by occult forces in a dingy men's room. It's a track stopper. Such writers as Kate Wilhelm, Ron Gollart, William F. Woe, and Steve Raznick, Tem, contribute another 16 stories. Additionally, there's nonfiction, including Jack Williamson's pair of mini-essays about style and tone, Kim Antonew's examining the nature of horror, and John Gustafson's writing about horror art. A lung full of crisp autumn air in an increasingly stuffy field, Pulp House should be supported. Pulp Arcanum is a podcast featuring content and discussions on the pulp fiction genres of 20th century literature, horror, adventure, fantasy, and sci-fi. The fantastical stories published in the 1920s pulp magazines ignited the era with an explosion of strange and weird tales. To participate in upcoming skull sessions on the podcast, email me directly at pulparcanum@gmail.com. That's PulparCanum. For Facebook, there's a page, Pulp Arcanum Podcast.
Also, many paperback collection photos are featured on the Instagram.
Coming September 2019, to record